Hello and welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast. I'm Paul, your host. This podcast is all about Porsche and their cars and the people and the technology and the engineering that goes behind it. You'll find your Porsche stories, which is us, me, talking to you about your Porsche, your journeys and your life experiences with those cars. Tech Talk, which is all about the technical aspects of Porsche. Waffle, which is just me whittering on about basically anything with some friends. And Heritage, which looks at the entire journey of Porsche from the earliest days to the present day. If that sounds interesting to you, then stick around. Welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome to episode 40. So last week I took a little break. Every now and again I will do that, pretty much just to prioritize my mental health, to give myself a bit of time away from Rengineering. Still kept connected, but it took quite a lot of time to put the introducing the Ren 550 video together, and that went out on YouTube a couple of weeks back. And as of today, has had 5,400 views, which is great. So if you've been over to YouTube and watched the introducing the Ren 550 video, then thank you very much. If you haven't yet, but you're still keen and you're interested in the Ren 550 project, which is the reason why Rengineering exists, then do that now. You can head over and watch it. If you want to listen to the audio version, you can listen to last week's or a couple of weeks ago episode, and that kind of walks you through everything that the plan is so far. So this episode, as I was wrapping up actually the introducing the Ren 550 episode, I started talking about introducing some of the partners in more detail, because I referenced them through that video and that podcast, but I didn't go into great detail because the intention is to go out and shoot Tech Talks or Heritage episodes with those individual companies to give them their opportunity to talk to me about what they do, why they're the best in the industry, and why it's a great idea for us to work together. This episode today is one of those. So I'm starting with somebody that I've known for best part of a decade now. I'm not going to do too much for the intro because that actually comes into the episode itself. But we'll get there. But before, if you've been a listener for the Rengineering YouTube and podcast for a while, you'll know that there's a little intro before we really get started into the episode, and this episode is no exception to that. So tomorrow I head off to Rensport in the UK, and they are a resto mod that sells them slightly short, Porsche air-cooled 911 producer, and I mean their stuff is absolutely phenomenal. You know, I'm off to see Tut Hill later in the year. I'm talking currently to Theon as well about catching up with them and spending some time with Theon. But the intent is to kind of get round and see all of these amazing resto mods in the UK. Obviously, there are ones in other parts of the world. And as Rengineering grows, the hope is that I'll get to see some of those as well. But Rensport invited me down to see them. They're in Moreton in the Marsh in the Gloucestershire area where I'm from originally. So I'm very excited to head down there tomorrow to do that. That's going to be really fascinating. I'm taking the drone. I'm taking all of the gear I normally take to shoot, so you'll see it'll be kind of a standard format, long form episode, as lots of these are. We're going to get lots of juicy B-roll as well, so should make for a really interesting episode. So that's tomorrow. What have I got going on? So we're getting really close for me to head off to Germany on my this year's road trip. So if you haven't seen it yet, last year I went to France and drove around the Alps, stopped at Monaco, stopped at Cannes, did Route Napoleon, Col de Torini, Col de la Bonnette, the highest looped road in Europe. Really got out and exercised the Outlaw Cayman, at Outlaw Cayman on Instagram, by the way, if you want to follow that particular account. This time I'm heading off and it's a slightly different version. Thankfully, it's a mix, right? So last year was a completely solo trip. This year is ever so slightly different. So I've got a few mates joining me. So, and I think I mentioned this in the previous episode, but cover again, it's no big deal. So Nathan, who's been on the channel a few times, he's a Formula One mechanic for Alpine F1. He's joining me. He's trying to get his MX-5 together. this is, I guess, one of the misconceptions that you think Formula One mechanics don't love grassroots stuff. Yes, of course they do. So here's NBMX5 Turbo. He's just trying to get that ready to take. But if he can't take that, he'll take his BMW M135i. So it's going to be a bit of a BMW-heavy trip because my other mate, Joe, and his dad, who I've known 25 years now, they're going in Joe's M5. So I'm crap with generations and model codes with M cars, but not the most recent version, but the version before that M5 anyway. So he's just kind of figuring out some last bits for that. And then on the 21st, I head down to, I'm actually staying overnight because our channel tunnel tickets are pretty early in the morning. So rather than having a stressful journey across to get down to Folkestone, I'm staying down there overnight before, and then we'll head off into France and then Belgium for a night. So it's a bit of a mix, this one, because Joe and his dad are joining me on the right from day one. And I'm not entirely sure what Nathan's plans are, because as you can imagine, he was in Japan a few days ago, and I know he's flown back to the UK now, but I think he's off again for a few days before he's back to go on this little trip. So it's a good old mix. I'm going to spend some time in Bastogne. If you're a Band of Brothers fan like I am, I wanted to go and mix it up. So some of it is going to be, the bulk of the trip is going to be Petrolhead Heaven. But I do want to get a couple of bits in there that are just sort of, yeah, less Petrolhead stuff, but really interesting as well. So I'm going to check out the 101st Airborne Museum at Bastogne and look at some of the foxholes and sort of try and picture, being ex-military myself, I'm really drawn to World War II stuff. The back end of the trip, when Joe and his dad shoot off and do their own thing because they're going to Ypres, Nathan's got to shoot off to America for the American Formula One Grand Prix. And I will shoot off my own. And at that point, I'm going to head to Normandy. I'm going to go to the D-Day beaches. So, yeah, there's going to be a mix of that stuff in there. But what I also will do is next episode, so, you know, just literally a few days before I leave for France and Germany, I'll talk you through the entire plan, everywhere I'm going, where I'm stopping, who I'm meeting, the plans for it all. But I'm not going to do that in this episode. So, what else we got? On the Theon car that I mentioned a few minutes ago about trying to book some time with Theon, Harry Metcalf released his video with that Theon car, and he was pretty deeply impressed, as you would imagine. I guess what is really interesting there is the carbon fiber construction that Theon typically make. Now, Theon aren't the only company to do that. Gunther Works do it. Tuthill do that, some of that stuff. Singer obviously do quite a bit of carbon work, but yeah, the feedback from Harry on the Theon car was really, really great. So if you get a chance to go and have a watch of that, that's my recommendation for this week. If you watched all the way back, on the channel from the early days, you will see a tech talk on geometry that Barnsport and so Scotty from Barnsport and I did. Also, if you live in the UK and you're trying to figure out who to go to, who's the best in the industry for setting up a wheel alignment, geometry, you know, dialing in your car and getting the absolute best from it, centre of gravity will absolutely come up. Centre of gravity have gone out and bought a Cayman GT4 981. So I guess what that tells me is, despite 911s being, you know, the holy grail of the Porsche brand, and that's never going to change, what's really interesting is when people are looking at it objectively, so extracting some of the emotion out. Obviously not everyone's going to agree with me, I'm fine with that, but I'm obviously a big Cayman fan, so it's great to see that Centre Gravity have bought a platform now to develop the 981 further, because obviously the 718 series, the most modern version of the Cayman and Boxster, and the 981 are principally the same chassis. So yes, there's lots of bits and pieces that are slightly different, but ultimately you can develop the same platform in as much the same way. So can I head at some point down to Centre Gravity and get them to check my car over, give me some thoughts? But Barnsport will always look after my car. In fact, I'm going there on Saturday, and I'll talk more about that in a sec. But it was really interesting to see Centre Gravity's investment in a GT4, because it really tells the story about how great they think that platform is. What else? So following on from that, actually, let's talk about Barnsport and my car going there. So the car heads off to Barnsport this weekend on Saturday for Scotty to take a look at it before the road trip. That makes a lot of sense, right? You might remember if you, I think it's probably two or three episodes back, that I'd fitted a 901.2 GT Sport steering wheel to the Outlaw Cayman. Now, that goes, the car goes in for trimming at Dave the Trimmers in a few weeks' time. But I wanted to get the steering wheel on beforehand. I did that. It was all good. Used the GPS adapter X kit, which allows the 981 to build in that functionality of the mode select switch on the steering wheel, the little rotating jog wheel. And it threw up, and I know why, an SRS or an airbag light on the dash. Gutted. And I thought I'd done all the research possible to make sure I knew what I was doing with that and actually what you need to do. And it's bloody obvious now, I thought of it. Figured it out, especially the 981 generation. I can't talk about previous generations, but they will go to sleep after half an hour, and I just didn't leave it long enough for the car to kind of go into a deep sleep. So when I disconnected the airbag and reconnected it again, it pinged the light on. I used my own kind of OBD reader to try and clear the code off. It won't let me do that because it's a safety function. So I've got to rely on Scotty to clear that down for me. At the time the car goes in for just a bog standard oil service, there's nothing needed this year. I absolutely rinsed myself in terms of funds last year servicing that car, and it had the lot, including brake fluid, the full works, doesn't need that this year. So quick oil service, but we're also going to do the GT3 steering map upgrade, so you can get into engineering mode you can buy a PWS 2 clone, and you can do it that way if you're particularly skilled. I don't have that much confidence in that with myself, and I haven't got the kit anyway. So I will hand that over to Scotty, and Scotty's going to unlock and change the configuration from the bog standard 981 configuration steering to the GT3. So I'm going to apply the GT3 steering config update, and I'll report back. Probably on the road trip, actually, because obviously I'm recording day by day on the road trip through Europe, so I can give you a bit of a feedback. After driving that car for 5.5, almost 6 years, I'm so used to that car and the way it handles right now that actually any change to that I'm probably going to be quite sensitive to. So be completely honest, if I drive it and we've done that map update, or that config update, and there's absolutely no difference as far as I'm concerned, I'll tell you that. If I think it's a revolution and we should all go off and do that stuff, I'll let you know that as well. So let's get into the episode then. So the main part of the episode, as I mentioned, we're starting to introduce the tech talks and the partners for the REM 550 build. And I kind of alluded a little bit earlier in the intro that actually some of that is to do with carbon fiber, because I talked about Tuthill and Singer and all the other good companies and Theon that do the carbon fiber work on their car. O-Sport Design, and Jake I've known for, like I said before, about 8-9 years now. Amazing guy, really, really, really interesting guy. And I hope you really enjoy the episode, because you get to find out stuff that, I mean, I learned stuff on the day, even though I've known him for quite a long time, that is fascinating about his back history and his family's connection to motorsport in general. So all that's coming up. But if we look at the REM 550 and Rengineering as a podcast and YouTube channel, the reason for it existing, I needed a partner to help me build the car. I can obtain a chassis. We're not going to make any amendments to the chassis. Things like suspension, it's relatively off the shelf. It's going to be the damping, the rebound, spring rates, all can be different. But ultimately, the actual way the suspension is set up on an Elise or an Exige, because that's what we're using, a Lotus chassis, 111 chassis. All going to be pretty much the same. The body, though, is completely, we're breaking new ground. There's going to be a lot of stuff to do to try and get that to work. Jake and O-Sport are going to be the guys that are going to do that. And you hear kind of live, what's really interesting is, because obviously we're watching it back, some live feedback straight away about what Jake's thoughts are in terms of how we can work together and his commitment towards re-engineering. And if you're out there now and listening to this and you're either a potential client or you're a potential sponsor for the REN 550, or you want to get involved in supporting Renngineering as a platform altogether, this is a really good one to listen to, because it really demonstrates how I like to work with companies. It's not a clinical, you know, slide of contracts across the desk, something gets signed and off we go. It's really important that there's personal relationships behind all that stuff, because, you know, the duration of time is unknown, the complexity, a lot of it's unknown. I'm doing something new in the YouTube space that is long form, which is not, you know, it's going to take a while for YouTube to pick it up, because it is new, right? You know, everybody wants something to happen overnight. You know, you watch the Matt Armstrong episodes, brilliant as they are, not criticizing Matt, by the way. You know, over two or three episodes, he's completely rebuilt a crashed car, a crashed Bentley, or a crashed Rolls, or whatever it is, Lamborghini Huracan, whatever. They're amazing, right? And they give you that kind of instant gratification of watching something. But this is not that. This is the big, long, get invested because we're in it for the long haul kind of stuff, right? So I am conscious that there's a different approach. And sometimes anything that's slightly different takes a while to find its audience. But, you know, what I will say is thank you for, you know, for supporting the channel so far. I still get, every time I drop a video or drop some podcast material or content, I get a handful of really important bits of feedback for me to keep me going, because, and I mentioned right at the early part of this episode, it's been, you know, I wanted that break, I needed a bit of time off, and I was feeling a bit low in motivation. That's fair. It's going to be peaks and troughs when you do this stuff and you kind of got a full-time job and doing it on your own. It's natural. And then I had a wonderful message saying, and not even from a new video, right? From my Frank Cassidy boxing gas heritage from, you know, last year, saying this guy's watched loads of interactions or interviews with Frank, and the Renngineering one was by far the best, asking the best questions and getting the best rapport. And for me, those bits of feedback are so important, because, you know, the podcast, you put a podcast out, I don't know whether it's hit. I don't know whether you're enjoying this. I do my best each time I do it, but I've no idea whether he's landing. So, you know, I do very much rely on those bits of feedback. So if you want to get in touch, share your thoughts, critical or praise, please give me some praise. I love a bit of praise. But you can do that at Renngineering UK on Instagram, at Renngineering everywhere else, or you can email me info@renngineering.com. Anyway, enough of me rattling on. Let me have a quick check. It's been 19 minutes, which is about standard for an intro. So I'm going to hand over to Jake Oliveira and myself from O Sport Design and in Oxfordshire, and we will pick it back up at the end. Welcome back to the channel. Welcome back to the Renngineering YouTube and podcast. And welcome, Jake of O Sport Design. How are you doing, Jake?
Good, very well, thank you. Good. And it's good to see you as well. I mean, we've known each other, I was trying to work it out, 2016, I think, was when we were discussing parts for the Lotus, and
that's it.
Never met each other in person, so it's actually really nice to catch up with you.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So I've been wanting to chat to Jake pretty much since I started Renngineering. When you think about the REN 550 build, I've talked about this a lot before, but it's going to be a carbon fiber top, Lotus chassis, and the rest of it's going to be re-engineered. So I've done some research into carbon manufacture before, but at a totally different level, so a totally different scale. We'll get into it, but Jake, his work, as he just talked about then, when I had my Lotus Elise and I was building that, I was really keen to find like really high quality parts, and I'm still really keen to find high quality parts. Now I'm kind of coming all full circle and starting to think about an entire build. The quality is the bit that stands out for me, and making sure that if there's any collaboration or kind of any work that goes on with a partner, that actually you can trust them, you've seen their work before, and that's where Jake and O Sport come in, is the fact that I've seen the quality of the work before, and I had a pre-prod version, and I've talked about this on the podcast, and it was off the level, off the scale good. So yeah, that's why I'm at O Sport today. But as with all of these things, all tech talks, rather than launch into talking about the actual tech itself, I like to learn about the person behind it. So, rather than getting into kind of what's going on right now, I like to take people all the way back to sort of the early years stuff. So for you, talk to me about earliest car memories.
Yeah, okay. So it really starts. I'm a Formula One fan through and through. From the earliest memory, really is of watching Formula One on a Sunday. And I was fortunate enough. My dad. All of this has come from my dad being in composites as well. My brother is as well. So my dad worked at Tyrrell in the 80s.
Wow.
So and in fact, my.
By the way, I don't know any of this. So this is all new to me as well. Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
My dad worked at Tyrrell. My uncle worked at Brabham.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we lived in Chessington in Surrey.
Yeah.
And Brabham's factory was in Chessington.
Wow.
Certainly in the 80s it was. I'm not sure if it was always there, but
yeah.
And Tyrrell was down the road near McLaren.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect all those teams were down that area because the Formula One race was at Brands Hatch, you know, so it makes sense that was the motorsport valley of the 70s and 80s. But so my dad got into composites, not, you know, you can imagine in the 80s composites was increasing. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
In Formula One, I think it was McLaren that brought it in the early 80s, but you can imagine the smaller teams, it was starting to sort of feed through the grid throughout the 80s. So
the first thing that jumps to my mind is Gordon Murray and the skirts, like that early day. I don't know if that was composite or whether that was aluminium.
I'm not sure, but he certainly was one of the pioneers.
Yeah.
And whether that was with Brabham, because he came from Brabham to McLaren eventually, I'm not sure. But as they do now, engineers
move
around and take the technology and the drawings in some cases with them. But
so
my earliest memories were going to the factory on a Saturday and seeing the cars, sitting in the cars, you know, and going to the races, going up to Silverstone to watch the Grand Prix when it was about seven corners and flat out pretty much the whole way around. And the smell of the fuel back then was incredible, and the sound, which we've lost now. But that's really where it started for me.
So motorsport was the kind of always the kind of, I was going to say the driver, and that's like horribly puke inducing, but that was where the source is, right?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to either drive one or design one. And that was from an early age. I was sketching things, and I've never quite got to becoming a designer in the purest form, but I raced karts and cars for as long as I could afford to throughout my sort of childhood. And
successfully, sort of or
we did all right at club level. We done well. My brother is unfortunately better than me, but we always competed very closely on the track. So it was always it's like having two teammates and battling. But we raced, you know, from the mid 90s through to up until about 10 years ago. Sort of had to give up racing to grow up, basically buy a house. Children were on the way and.
Mm.
You know, and it'll probably come back. I'll be one of those guys that's sort of 50-year-old trying to mix it with the 20-year-olds in 10 years' time. You know,
still so in karts. You still like
no in cars. In cars. You know, we moved through and raced in Formula V, which is a Beetle engine, a bit like a Formula Ford, but with an air cooled engine, Porsche style. You know, we went that way because of the people we spoke to, and you go up to the Autosport show and you get involved with people and.
Mm.
So naturally went that way. It was great racing. It's a great class if you want to just tune and tweak and play with things, because it's quite a freedom without being, it's the same as Formula 4. There's no aero allowed, but there are things you can do, suspension, mechanical developments you can
engines sealed, are they like
engines? No, you can tune the engine to a degree. There's a set of regulations.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good set of regulations. It's a good formula.
You can still there's still elements of creativity and innovation.
Absolutely.
You can apply to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. And so that's for someone that has an engineering thought process and come away from the race and go, what can I do to improve? What can we do to the car to improve and see progression throughout a season or over a period of years? You know, because it's not like you chuck a car away at the end of the year. You develop that car over a period of 6 or 7 seasons, maybe.
Of course.
You know, and there are still cars racing now that were racing 10 years ago and when I started 20 years ago.
So a friend of mine, Alistair Moffat, he's BTRDA auto test champion. He's been like 8 times champion now. And he's had the same mini special for, I think, 20 odd years.
Absolutely.
Same thing, it just develops each year. It just makes it a little bit better, shaves a bit of fat off here.
Absolutely,
Slightly better components, people have developed new stuff, and he's still BTRDA champion, so.
Yeah, so it's working.
It's working, yeah. That kind of iterative process in design and engineering is a big part of it, right? Unless you've got a blank checkbook, which most people don't, you've got to do something and have some fun.
Yeah, and do it yourself, and if it doesn't work, change it.
Yeah.
Come back next time and try again.
So that's the kind of the racing bit and the, to an extent the engineering bit. So where there's a difference between scribbling some stuff on a page or trying it out on a cart and then thinking, I want this to be my career.
Yeah.
So were you, when you were in school, were you thinking about doing kind of sciences, maths, those sorts of subjects?
Well, I did. I wasn't very good at it, but I did. All of my A-levels were sciences, maths. But I didn't really, I didn't go to uni. So everything I've done is purely based on experience and starting as a trainee in composites. And I guess the engineering came in because my first composites job was producing parts as we see on the table here. Mm-hmm. And clearly I wasn't very good at it because within 6 months they've moved me into the machine shop. So I became a machinist. So
that's not, you know what, that's, I know it probably at the time hurt a little bit, but at the same time, that breadth of experience and understanding how different materials will be used together, there's an element of like
Real development there. I think that's absolutely what sort of, like I say, makes me good at what I do now, but I would say the design that I do is, I would call it manufacturing design, which is designing to produce something, and because I've got that background, that it's so important to understand how something's made to be able to design something better.
Especially if the clients are kind of, they're expecting you to have a level of understanding that they don't want you to kind of have to go away and research, they just want you to know and understand what the design looks like or a brief, whatever it is, and you're doing the actual design work, but they want you to know straight away.
Yeah.
So,
I was a machinist, and particularly machining in the composites industry. So I worked for a subcontractor that, you know, there was Formula One parts going through the factory, and it was in Brackley, so naturally there was, at the time, it was Honda or BAR at the time, and up the road you've got Red Bull and you've got Renault or Benetton and things like that. So there were lots of Formula One projects coming through the door, and being a machinist in a company like that, you get involved in billet machining metals to machining carbon itself. You know, there's a lot of inserts and things that go into chassis, so machining hard carbon fibre dry and extracting the dust, you know, it's a completely different material to try and cut.
Yeah, of course.
Or machining patterns, you know, epoxies and things like that. That's a big part of what I did. So I became really, if what you would call me 30 years, say in the 60s or 70s, I would be a pattern maker or tool maker.
Okay,
you know, that's essentially what I ended up becoming, was a tool maker, but using a CNC tool as my tool rather than so much my hands, and carving out of wood and materials.
Amazing.
So I used CAD and CAM software, and that's how I got involved in using those packages, because they very often work so closely to one another. You know, you have a CAD model, and you move it into a manufacturing environment to put your tool paths on for your machine, and then you post process that program. So naturally, I was jumping between CAD and CAM for 15 years of my career before I went on to further things. But from being on the tools and programming and designing tooling, I really enjoyed using the software. I used Siemens NX, which is one of the sort of go-to CAD packages that most of the Formula One teams use now. That or CATIA, you've probably heard of CATIA.
Yeah.
So I actually took 18 months and I went and worked for somebody that taught people how to use the software. So I would go and train people to use it, which only made me better. And the funny thing is, when you use a package like that, you only use a small portion of it. There's so much in the background you don't get to use. But when you go and train people how to use it, you get new questions. They ask you how to do something, and you go and find out, and you come back with the answer. And so I broadened my sort of knowledge base of the software for that 18 months. And
were you doing anything for yourself at this point, or was it?
So yes, sorry, I've jumped forward slightly. So while I was at company Freeform Technology, a machine shop in Buckingham, and with my dad in composites and my brother in composites too.
They're still actively working at that point, and they kind of...
They were, so they both worked at what is now Aston Martin.
Okay. Right.
So they were both in, I don't know what year, you'd have to determine what name the team was called, but whether it was Midland Spiker or Force India or Racing Point, they worked there for the last 20 years, you know, since my dad actually joined, in fact, my brother joined as well, the last years of Jordan. So so it's all the way through all the different guises that team's become, and left only in the last year. My dad left in the last year to come here just as they moved into their new factory. So yeah, quite recent. So with a family of composites, engineers, technicians, whatever you want to call us, with that experience, I had a desire to start producing my own parts for me. You know, I had a
Your
Lotus.
Personal car,
yeah,
right,
I wanted to make something for me, and if I could sell a few, get some interest, sell a few, it might cover the cost of doing it. But the main thing is, I start to build a name. I start to get a bit of a feel for what it is like to run a business at this stage.
Yeah.
Get to work with my brother and my dad, because I dodged. I'm going to say dodged working directly in Formula One. I've never had a desire to be in a Formula One team. I love
so
Formula
interesting,
One,
isn't it? Because you would think,
but
that,
I know what it can be like to work for a Formula One team, and I've always enjoyed being part of a smaller team and being a slightly bigger part, and maybe a flexibility to be different hats or whatever it's called, you know, to play, to, it's not to say play more of a part, but just have a bit more touch and be involved in more things.
You know, when I'm trying to visualize it, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels that kind of 70s and 80s era, and probably
that would have absolutely been,
it would
like
have
that.
Been, you know, like everybody knows each other by name, probably goes to each other's weddings and all that sort of stuff. And obviously it goes as manufacturing becomes more slick, or some stuff's outsourced, you know, and there's probably a core group of people. In fact, I know, because I know people that are in Formula One. There's a core group, but at the same time, some teams are less family oriented than others.
Yes.
Again, I can't necessarily talk about specifics, but there is. So I can. So if I was in your shoes, and I wanted that kind of, that closeness, that close knit feeling, that everyone's completely bought in, and you know, would bleed for that team, that kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Then you'd be more interested. But actually, if it feels more disconnected and there's less emotion and kind of,
I think the teams have grown to 1,000 people now. And of course they need to be. The cars are incredible pieces of machinery, but in the 80s, a team may have been 60, 70 people. And that definitely would have felt like a family. But I was close enough with family members in the teams to know exactly what was going on. And I supported their team and things like that. And we'd all sit down together on a Sunday and watch the race.
It's trippy, because I'm thinking about this now. I went to Force India to have a walk round and sat in the sim, and I was like playing with the steering wheel and things like that. And it's trippy that, thinking about it, every chance that your family parts and pieces were like in that rig.
Yeah. Oh, completely.
Wow.
I mean, Sam being, having a racing background, Sam, my brother, he actually very often jumped in the sim for Force India, because what they do, obviously you get these mirroring sessions now on a Friday, and you can, you know, the teams go out practicing on a Friday, and you hear that someone's been in the simulator all night on a Friday night. Sam would very often go in on a Thursday night and calibrate. You know, he'd run the circuit, making sure it's ready. So, so he used to love doing that as well. You know, but I think the most important thing with something like a simulator is the consistency.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to necessarily put a quick time in, but if you can feel the difference between setup changes or an aero package or an aero balance change, then that's the important thing. Anyway, I dodged working in Formula One. We started producing some parts in the evenings for ourselves. I had this vision of making some composite parts for my Lotus.
What was it? It was an Elise, right?
It was an Elise, It was the same as yours, except for it was the K series.
No, it was K.
It was yours K as well. Oh, but did you change the engine?
No, that was the plan. It was going to, Dan from HP was going to build me a NA K20A.
Right.
And we talked about off camera, bought a house, needed to get some cash, and the car never got fully built, but everything else was done apart from the engine.
Gotcha. Okay.
So it was okay then.
Same car. So I made these parts. I made a diffuser. I made the rad ducts, one of the bench, and generated a bit of interest. There was a lot of interest. Too much to do. I probably did a run of about 20 sets of radiator ducts at the time. But it was getting too much to try and manage that in the evenings as well as a day job.
Of course,
we decided to sort of go, you know, we're gonna put this to bed for now. I liked that.
I'll be honest with you, I was gutted when you did that because I was like, oh man, like, there's so few people out there that were in that space of. There's lots of kind of a bit rough off the shelf stuff that came from who knows where with minimal design. And you could, and I looking at your stuff, I just knew that there's loads of thought gone into it.
Well, I wanted to sell something that I would be happy in purchasing, and not, as you just said, I don't want to unbox something and feel like you've then got to do all the work to build it.
Yeah.
I wanted to deliver it, say it went on the car. I mean, and you could literally put them on the car in 5 minutes.
If
you,
it was
three bolts. It's undo the access panel, put it on. You know, so, and that's one of the other bits. You know, we'll talk about that later. But so. Where are we?
So you kind of started winding it down and kind of thinking.
Yeah, I winded it down. I mean, it was a lot of work, but I'd got a taste. The without spending a lot of time really pushing the product, it's very difficult to keep the pipeline of interest coming through. Yeah. And there's obviously, and there's no disrespect to people that own Lotus. I was a Lotus owner as well. There's only so much that a Lotus owner wants to spend on stuff like that. It might not be
I
the right market.
I think that's changing.
It might be changing,
But definitely 10 years ago, you know, I paid $7,500 for my Elise. I mean, trying to buy
exactly,
one now,
exactly.
They're all kind of 15, 20 grand for a basic car. And actually, I think the audience, they've aged and their financial situation has changed. So I don't, and probably the Emira and, you know.
Of course.
There's a different client, I think, now. Yeah. Well, it's definitely heading that way. So I think there's an option for kind of more Singer-style Lotus stuff.
And on the newer models.
On the newer models, but I think there's renewed interest in the older stuff because there's nothing analog anymore. Everything's...
Sure.
Even my Cayman, you know, electric power steering and, you know, you can... I know that I've lost something from that kind of brain connected to the tyres thing. I know that. Mm. So I do think that there's going to be more interest in... But if you're trying to, there's a difference between what I think and then trying to run a business, right? So there's got to be some commercial viability to keep you, you know, to move from a day job into doing something.
Yeah,
like that.
And designing and starting to produce products, it can take a long time. There's a lot of investment initially, so it wasn't something that we could organically build at that point into something that we could work full time in at that point. And what we did was liked that. I'd left my job and moved to somewhere else. And then that's when my wife and I decided to have children. And really what struck up the idea to sort of start the business properly was that my wife wanted to be full time with the children. Mm. Additional income we needed to find. So what I actually did, and it wasn't so much the composite production, it was to do the tooling design, tooling design, because I could do that in the evenings and weekends on a laptop in my office. So I got the okay from my employer. They were happy for me to do it, which was really nice. And so I did that for 18 months. I started my new job. I was training people in with the software, and I was also sort of moonlighting and building up a customer base, and it was busy. Mm. You know, it was too much, but I loved it. I will work till 3 a.m. and I love every job I do. I've not got bored of it yet, and I still don't. And people think, I'm mad to want to do it so much, but I just love, every project is completely different. Mm. I like the pressure, because everything is, I need it next week, you know.
Yeah, and that's, so I think we're inching towards current stuff, and
we are
so current clients, and I think we can't talk about some things clearly, like Formula One, things would probably wise.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about, there were Formula One projects, there are Formula One projects that I do get involved in, but a lot of the time the Formula One teams take care of it themselves. They outsource the manufacturing of the parts, but rarely up until recently, which I'm very pleased to say, do they allow somebody else to design the tooling for their part. Up until recently,
probably
they've controlled everything.
Probably tolerances, reliability, absolutely. Failure modes, all sorts of stuff that
absolutely.
They want to know about.
And it's completely understandable. So what they would very often do is they'd have someone in-house design the tooling, that would go straight to the machine shop or the composites company. They would take care of all of it and provide the finished part to drawing. Mm. So I wouldn't tend to get involved in Formula One projects. I got involved in everything below Formula One.
Right.
So all the sports cars, things like ProDrive type projects and, and Multimatic and the sort of cars they get involved in. You know, those sorts of clientele are the sorts of people that I tend to work a lot for. Mm. And it's either directly or indirectly, because what happens very often is that they will have a department that is outsourcing. It will get sent out to four or five people for quotation. Mm. And very often I can see that come from five different people back to me again, you know. So,
right,
okay. So round and about, I ended up doing a lot of work for the industry in the UK. Well, I still do. Obviously, there's other people doing it as well. But it's there is, what I would say is I've found what I'm really good at or really happy doing, and I really enjoy it. And I think what happens very often is it's a means to an end, tooling design. I think a lot of composites is throwaway in Formula One and motorsport. You know, we need the parts and we need them in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah.
Don't care so much how we get there. We just need the parts on the car then. So very often it's not that it's not thought about, but it's given to somebody else to take care of.
Yeah.
You know, and if you think about it also, if the end customer hands over the whole project, it's their responsibility to deliver the parts. So you can design the tooling how you want to, as long as you've given me what I've asked.
Yeah.
If that customer has to control the design as well, and it doesn't go right, then who's
yeah.
You know, it's not a blame culture, but essentially have it all, be responsible for everything.
You know, like it's you know, everything's got to be right all the time. So
absolutely. Yeah, so okay. and then a composite company, if they're designing the tooling and they're controlling that, they're designing how they want to use the tooling, they're going to do a better job.
You know,
sometimes you get something and you go, how, I don't know how to make the part off this mold. You know, it's designed by someone else. So all sorts of things. And off the back of that, and I did that part time from 2017 through to 2021.
Right.
I did that part-time, evenings and weekends. It got to the point where I was doing probably a week's worth of work outside of my day job. It got to the point where I was doing 30, 40 hours a week
on top of a
full-time job, which was great, but I was starting to feel it. I was burnt out.
By the way, I am doing 30 hours on top of my day job, and I'm not getting paid shit. So.
Okay, yeah. Bring it back down to earth. So
like and subscribe. Anyway, yeah, sorry.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, there's no excuse. So it got to the point where I can switch over it very soon. I'm at a point where I can really make a decision.
You can see it sustaining itself.
Absolutely. Yeah. At this point in time, I could switch. Okay, I lose the additional income, but I've just gained all that capacity. So I could do 60 hours a week.
Yeah.
You know, but do it in the daytime and get some evenings back with the children and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so. So I actually, between teaching how to use the software and being essentially a CAD CAM apps engineer was what I was. I was on the end of the line for anybody that had an issue or, you know, a technical support team, part of a technical support team. I loved it.
Mm.
Quite a lot of commuting to get down to where they were based, and there was a lot of travelling because I would sometimes be on site with customers. In fact, I didn't dive in too deeply on that. A lot of the projects were aerospace, so I got to be involved in, moved away from motorsport and automotive into aerospace projects. And we would offer CAM. So when I say CAM, it's computer aided manufacturing.
Yeah.
So it's all the projects and the processes to make the stuff on a CNC or a lathe, and an automation of that. You know, sometimes that, you know, it's press the button
and off it goes.
And we would, the company I worked for would get involved in projects like that. It was amazing. I mean, and also really enjoyed the people I was working with. They were the experts in their field, and I was just like going to work and learning. I love going to work and learning. When that runs out, it's time to move on.
Yeah, of course.
And that didn't happen, but it was at this point where I went, well, an opportunity came up. I did a project for, I can talk about it now because it doesn't exist anymore, but do you remember the Robo Race project, the autonomous race car?
Take
a look. It was a very futuristic thing. It looked like it came out of Tron. In fact, the designer of the car designed all the Tron film, the legacy film. So incredible looking machine.
Cool.
And it was fully autonomous, electric. And
I'll put some pictures and images in. You'll see that.
Yeah, it's a really, really cool car. And they moved from that into essentially the company that was doing it was using this as a bit of a test bed to test the systems for road cars. They had their second car, which was, I think, the Metabot, which was based on an LMP2 car. So what they would then do, had the ability to put a driver in and compare the driver to the machine.
That's cool.
So they would have competitions where the driver would do a lap and then the car would do a lap. The driver would get out. And in fact, they did Goodwood.
They did it
a few years ago.
Yeah,
I think the driver pulled up, got out, and the car drove off, sort of thing.
You know, I remember seeing some video of that.
You've got to admit, there was a limitation to the speed of the car. You know, there is still a lot of limitation to what they can do, but it found its way all the way up the hill, you know, at a reasonable pace. But that particular car, again, based on an LMP2, I did all the tooling design for them indirectly, and I think I turned it around in a couple of weeks, the whole car.
Wow.
And they got me in, basically. So, like, first of all, how the hell did you do it?
Yeah.
We want you to come and work for us.
I bet.
So that was my next move. I was like, fantastic, I want to come and do this for you.
Was it you then kicking off a limited company or a sole trading?
Not at this stage. So I was sole trader all this time. Doing the part-time stuff. I did say, I want to continue my work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it would have to be
subsumed into their business.
Yeah, so I'm happy to come and work for you on the future projects, but I want to also continue doing my own stuff.
Of course.
That was absolutely fine. I did that for 3 years. And it was at that point, at the end of that journey, that I decided that I would go full-time, limited company. And that, again, wasn't even composites production. So this is still... In that time, we had some customers that came to us, please make some parts for us. So we did roll out the old molds, and we did another batch of 20 at some point in that time.
Yeah.
But again, the same issues happen. You know, it's a lot of commitment. But it generated funds to buy things like my software and my laptop and stuff like that. So, you know, so I went limited company full time, did that for a year. So we're now up to the start of 2022.
Mm.
And my dad is technically retired now. So he's coming to the end of up to retirement. And we were talking about what we could do. Now, this unit's very small, but we have the other one at the other end. There's four here.
Yeah.
We've had that for years. We used to run our race cars out of there. And we've always had it. It's just it's glorified garage.
Yeah, sure.
We were like, well, what can we do? We could start making some composites. He's into motorbikes, and now start building a motorbike, you know, generate a bit of income, cover, you know, basically employ him for him to help me out and for him to keep busy. I think it's very important that your mind stays active don't want to retire and
especially when you've
become old,
a,
you know.
No, of course, and I'm sure he didn't, right? I'm sure
he's not
keen to just maybe manage the amount of effort and work, so he's not like 80-hour weeks every week, but still, you like I said, keep active physically and mentally, for sure.
Because he's got such a skill, you know, he's always had his hands. I can't do what he can do.
Yeah.
So we were thinking, this is 2022. So he came to work for me, and this unit came up, obviously three doors down.
Yeah.
We were like, well, let's take it on, and then we don't have to chuck out everything that's in there to set up something for composites.
Right.
So we started rolling out some of our old parts, and starting to produce some parts again, starting to scan new parts, and just starting to get a feel. There was no pressure. The good thing was...
Mm.
It's relatively low. It doesn't cost too much to run a unit like this. So it wasn't really costing us much. The design side of the business was certainly supporting it, you know.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, over time, if I can bring it up and it takes the pressure off of the other side of the business, then that would be brilliant. And then my brother became available, let's say, towards the end of 2022, decided to move on from where he was. And we discussed whether him joining me and making this something more serious.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's only so much you can do with one person or one and a half people, me being the half.
Right.
But if I've got two experienced composite technicians, what can I do with that? You know, I'm the one that's lucky. Not giving them an opportunity. I'm the lucky one. I've got two guys.
Comes across, mate. And, you know, without flattering you too much, very humble about all of this, you know, and very kind of respectful. I mean, the family members anyway, but I think you'd be like that with anybody that you represent, you know, recognize their skill level. You'd be, they're fantastic and
absolutely
they're supporting me, right?
So,
credit.
So Sam came to join us September last year. So we're a year into that journey now. And Sam has always, you know, you can imagine his career path. You know, he's been 20 years into composites, doesn't always want to come to work and make carbon fibre parts.
Yeah.
So we got the scanner and we started, you know, okay, we've got plans to have more 3D printers and things like this, but we often, you know, purchased, you know, he'll design some jigs and things like that, 3D printed, and we get them produced or we make them ourselves. But so he's taken on a lot of the reverse engineering of the scanning of the parts. I'll do the surfacing, and we're picking up a lot of work that way. So we can look into that.
We'll do a little bit. You know, we'll cut and do some. I'll do some B-roll, and we can talk about that anyway. But the bit I think I'm interested in from here is there's a bit of an if you build it, they will come situation, but. How do you go from that to Tut Hills 911K? Like, that doesn't, they don't just go, Richard doesn't phone you up and go, guys,
no.
You've got some projects over here. So, like, walk me through, like, there's got to be okay, some business so, development and kind of conversational yeah. stuff there.
Well, first.
Oh, by the way, Tut Hill.
We do a little bit of Tut Hill, but we can talk about that, I'm sure. So, first of all, I live in the village that Tut Hill factory is in. So, for me, you know, I popped in one day. Again, I'd done some work indirectly for them. Email chains go round, people get to know each other. So I pinged a chap over at Tut Hill if I could pop in one day and show him what we're up to. I'm in the village, you know, if there's anything we can do. It was no pressure on my side, but he was just like, absolutely come in, I've got something for you.
Awesome.
Oh,
wow, right.
Well, wow. something to discuss. Talk about. Yeah. Can you do it? Yeah. So I walked in, I took some of the parts we'd done, and he walked me straight over to what is the gold car.
Yeah,
which was, you know, I'm talking, where were we? January this year. Mm-hmm. So, and that car's been 90% built, and obviously things have been changed and on and off the
car for
a year, I would say. I don't know anything before then.
Just out of interest, have you watched the Chris Harris?
Over and over again.
Yeah,
I love it, absolutely love
man,
it.
I've watched that. I'll put a link in the description, but yeah, if you haven't watched the 911K, I mean, that video is epic. It's so cool.
Yeah.
Anyway,
sorry. Yeah. No, it's cool. So what I loved about the project with Tut Hill, you know, I went in there and, can you do this? We want to do this. We don't know how to do it. Can you do it? And they've got a workshop full of technicians and engineers and fabricators and these core skills. But they're probably haven't got the expertise in composites, even though they want to do these things, they don't have it in-house. So they are relying on our external resource there.
And I'm guessing, I can't speak for them obviously, but their requirements would be that the person, because their level of perfectionism is so high, they have to come with a back history of experience.
Well,
it's not somebody that's kind of sat and done some wet molds in their back garden and gone, here it is. It needs to come with like proper engineering design background for it.
Yeah, I think obviously the first job was the audition. Absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
So it was a low risk part. Well, I say low risk, it was the handbrake assembly. But it was.
Is that it, by the way?
That's the one we've done. These are the parts in ready to be lacquered and things like that. But we were given the existing assembly, go away, scan it, reverse engineer it. So model it back up in CAD, make some changes that they wanted to make because there were things. So it this is what Tut Hill are really good at. It looks like the original.
Yeah.
You know, it's very subtle. But there are things that have just been changed that they wanted to tweak. Not to mention the weight. Every single thing you switch to composite or carbon fibre is going to be weight saving. Even on an assembly of that size, you're looking at 1.5 kilo saving. You know, it's big.
You aggregate all of that, saving
absolutely.
It up, and then
absolutely.
And that's where you get to weight and whatever it is, 45 kilos.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So we made the first one of those. Naturally, you make one, love it, not quite right, change it. And I think that's where I would say O Sport. We are there as an extension of our customer, and we take it away, we change it, we do it.
Willingly,
but it's because at the end of the day, they don't want us to go, well, that's what you ordered, that's what I'm billing you for.
For sure.
And if you want any changes, that's additional, but it's a relationship.
It's a collaboration.
There was, you know, no one had done anything wrong. It was only until you make the first one do you find out that actually that's not quite right. What can we do here? So we would make a few changes, tweak it, send it back. And we've got to a point now where we're sending these in. Obviously, they're building up stock for the other 911Ks.
Of course they are,
And so every time I would go in to Tuthill, there would be another project to discuss, you know, because there are still many things on those cars, and there's not just the 911K. Mm. There's every other car that they do there, and I'm not a Porsche expert. Mm. But there's newer versions, and there's obviously customer cars that are coming in for servicing and paint jobs. Yeah.
They're probably looking for parts that are kind of, you know, development of what they might have had 10 years ago, there's new options for them.
But they come in and go, well, it's in, I'll have the interior updated, well, we can shave some weight out of here. And, you know, so we've done a few things with Tuthills. Love working with them. Absolute a pleasure to work with. So much fun. And I've even said to my wife, I said, if O-Sport goes wrong, I'm taking my CV down to South Richard. Right? Yeah, because I would love to work there.
So one thing I wanted to mention, right, this is a key point for Rengineering. And just to remind people that have just come to the channel, Rengineering is building a 550 Spider, evocation, if you want to call it that. The same sort of mentality as Tuthill and Singer, and so the quality's got to be really high. But what we've just talked about here, if you're interested as a graduate engineer and you're interested in being involved in the 550, this is the bit you need to understand, is that there will be an expectation that you might not have had before, where stuff gets handed back to you and you will need to kind of go away and do some rework, and you have to be okay with that. I certainly get it all the time in my day job, and we've just literally talked about it from a commercial activity, there's that as well. But I want to give you as close to a proper working experience as you will get in the industry. So if you're thinking about applying, bear this in mind, because it's a key part of it. Anyway, I don't mean to distract, but yeah.
Not at all. Where were we?
So kind of got to this point now where Tuthill is,
we're working collaboratively with them, and that's a great customer. But there's other projects that I've had to, obviously no one's going to know you're there unless you tell them you're there. So I've had to start sort of put my marketing hat on and go out into LinkedIn and start to sort of generate some interest that way and go and meet people. And but at the same time, I don't want it to grow so hard so quick that we fail our customers. You know, we need to, needs to, and that's the balance, is to make sure that we're growing.
Either in production quality or customer service, the kind of the relationships that you have maintained and established because of exactly what you said, there's a collaboration process and a real kind of joined up level of thinking with what they're aspiring to do and what you can do. If you take on too much, then you've got two really key customers and something goes out that the QC wasn't quite done where you'd normally do it, and then that damages the brand for you.
Exactly.
Right? You can't have that. It's not acceptable.
So I don't want the quality and the service to be affected by taking on too much too soon.
Yeah.
And I mean, we still have more capacity. I mentioned to you off camera beforehand, 80% of our business is still very much the design.
Sure.
And that, for me, bear in mind now, my dad works for me, my brother works for me, my wife is a director of the business.
Mm.
If things go wrong, I feel like there's a lot of pressure now to make this work, and there's no issue there at all. But it's my responsibility to make this work for all of them.
Yeah.
And obviously the extended family in all directions. But I think what I want to do is build up and continue. I was really clear in what I wanted to achieve with the composite side of the business, because we're not doing it necessarily the same as other people. You've been to composite companies, and there are a lot of players out there that are fantastic at what they do, and we're absolutely not trying to do what they do. And they probably aren't looking to do what we're doing.
For sure.
You know, so that's great. I don't want to. It's a market that's, you know, in Motorsport Valley, if you want to call it that. Oxfordshire, Northamptonshire, Buckinghamshire, there's a lot of people, and composites is big, you know, so doing it the same as everybody else, you've got to either be really good or really cheap to get something. So I want to be really good and offering something different to what is out there already. And going back to what we offered, or what we could offer Tuthill and any of our customers, being a tool maker, And as you probably know, what often kills a project is getting to the start line.
Yeah.
And the cost and the investment in producing, getting to be able to produce the part, you've got to spend a lot of money to make the tooling to even get through the design process. So I've always had a vision that I was going to revolutionize tooling. It was a dream. But to, if I could come up with a way that tooling meant that you were enabling people to get, enabling people to make composite parts or any molded parts more easily, more accessible to more people, then that's a win-win, you know. And it is typically a very expensive cost process. The materials that are involved in tooling are expensive. Yeah. There's a lot of manual labour. You know, it's all manual. So it's just something you can't get away from a lot of the time. So we have, equally to all the parts we've been producing, we've been developing some, I would say we're developing is not the right word, but exploring other ways and means to produce tooling that aren't quite necessarily as expensive without losing the quality.
Yeah.
This probably sounds interesting to what you want to do.
Yeah, because, for sure. Because my ears are pricking up.
For ourselves, you know, if I want to grow the product line, the investment's on me. I've got to come up with that. So we've come up with some really, I say, we haven't done anything from scratch. Everything that we've done is out there, but we may have pulled together things and make a combination of things work. And it gives us options. We've got five or six different ways to make tooling, depending on the price point, depending on the quality requirement, depending on the lead time.
Yeah.
You know, and things like that appeal to customers. If you can get them to the start line and it's 50% cheaper than what they're used to, then why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah.
It's not meaning necessarily that I'm making less money. A lot of it's materials, you know. So the labour is still there to produce something, but everyone's saving.
Yeah, and I guess if you're using less material, there's less waste, and that's an environmental benefit, right? If they've got a target for, you know, environmental savings of their kind of whatever.
Absolutely.
It is, that, you know, composites. Again, you can teach me on this because I'm not an expert, but it's probably, correct me if I'm wrong, hard to be environmentally conscious, I guess, because there's a lot of waste, solvents,
absolutely,
and lots of things you use.
It's not a particularly sustainable process.
It's not, but it's a necessary, right? It's a part of the industry. But if you can lessen the amount of waste because you're not producing as much,
absolutely,
then you've got that's a saleable point.
Absolutely. And there are products now in the market where the virgin material is already 50% recycled. So switching to other materials that are out there, that because there's usually one flavour of material that everybody uses. It's very good at what it does.
Yeah.
But if you just explore further afield, there are other things you can do the same thing with that are more sustainable and usually cheaper as well. You know, so there's a cost saving and an environmental benefit.
So moving forward then, so for you, it's about, using the word sustainable again, but sustainable growth.
Yes.
Allowing you to maintain and kind of build the capacity of the company, but also provide excellent service, really high quality parts, lots of collaboration,
for sure,
lots of kind of close customer working. And
yeah,
I just keep growing. But
keep growing. Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to say, everything we've done so far, I've not taken a loan out to do it. We've had to do it based on, it's just been organic growth.
It's amazing.
You know, we have some money in the pot. We invest in some machinery. I mean, if we can talk about the kit that's behind you.
Please,
you know, I don't even know how it works, but but no, we'll talk about that later. But that's another molding process that we want to sort of get involved in, and I have been involved in the past. And just the machinery came up at the right time, and again, just I don't want to be reliant upon one thing, either design or our own products. And if something goes quiet, everything goes quiet. You need to have
diversity.
You need to have these different revenue streams.
Of course you do.
And that's going to be the future. So for me, it's not necessarily more profit. It's just being more level, you know, actually having a stability.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Amazing.
So
if I can move us very slowly towards the Ren 550 then.
Mm.
111 chassis, really familiar with that, both are. Now, here's the bit. Someone made a comment a while back and it sat with me, it's annoyed me a little bit, that I think I know more than I do. I'm fully willing to accept where I don't have any knowledge in the area. So the idea is, one lamb chassis, fiber steel. They're going to send over there, and my terminology is not going to be correct here. Wherever I say something that's not right, just ask questions or correct me. They're willing to send their buck over, right? Yep. And they said, yeah, we'll do that, absolutely fine.
What, is this a glass fiber?
They're normally producing glass fiber.
Okay.
Obviously, I want to produce it in carbon fiber. Yep.
So you want to tool off of the buck?
Well, so here's the thing, right? Is I need to, again, I want the quality to be really high, and I'm happy that what they produce is really good quality.
Yeah.
There's a couple of bits, though. One is, it sounded to a layman like a really good way of having a baseline starting point, right? They're willing to send that over just for the cost, and I would send it back when I finished. Mm. But I guess the question for me is, I'd have to go and 3D scan a body or something and then load that in and then build something off that.
Yeah.
So given those two options, is it logical to have them send something over, or is that kind of more complex for you as a manufacturer to be able to use that? And would you rather kind of take a scan? Because there's the bit, and I'll shut up in a sec, but obviously that body is not designed to fit a 111 chassis.
Mm.
So the complex bit will be, there will be an element of where, again, Lotus Elise has like a molded pieces that are glued effectively onto the chassis. So would have to then design something to adapt that body to sit on that chassis.
Yeah.
That's where the complexity
is. Do you have CAD of the chassis?
I have an option for it.
Okay.
So,
but again, you could scan it.
Yeah,
need to be, when you're talking about assembly models like that, you don't need to necessarily, excuse me, scanning a model gets you to a level of a model. It's a representation of right. that part in CAD space. It's typically an STL format.
Yeah.
It's not really a CAD model. It's just a 3D visual. Yeah. But it's perfectly adequate for checking for collisions. If you scanned the body and you had the chassis and you put them on top of each other, you'd see clearly what needed to be made up.
That, in my head, that was the bit. Again, because I've never used SolidWorks, I've never used Fusion 360. So all of these things that people are really familiar with, or more, you know, high level corporate stuff than that, commercial stuff, I'm starting from scratch. Mm. I'm an engineer, but I'm not in this space. So it's a massive case of learning. So
I guess the answer is you can do either, and neither is any worse than the other. If they're it's a molded body, so you can at least guarantee that within reason that molded body that they're producing is the same each time. Your alternative is to scan a car in the UK.
And I have access to one,
but is that genuine? Would that be a genuine one? So that would have been like panel beaten.
There'd be inconsistencies all over the place, right?
So you've got to ask, if you go and scan a UK car or original car, it certainly won't be symmetrical by any stretch of the imagination. Sure. And whether they moulded off of an original is another question.
Yeah.
It depends if you want to make things, you know, because a lot of people will scan something and go, right, cut it down the middle, mirror, I'm starting again.
There's a part of me that loves the idea of it being really high quality, like the production being really high quality, and it's lightweight and all the lovely stuff that you get from carbon manufacture, but actually pretty cool to have something that's like
molded with the imperfections in.
There's no technical thinking, and this is all live kind of conversation now, not anything that's been pre-planned, but I love the idea of having something that's like, that doesn't look quite right, but actually then you can kind of go, but it's based off a genuine car. I don't know, I'm kind of rambling there, but I like the idea.
I had actually, it reminds me of a project, I had the same thing, because a lot of cars that are designed from the ground up will be sim up through the centre line, but a particular car that's been done recently based on a classic car kept the non-sim aspect of the whole car set. But then if you think of it from a CAD point of view, everything left and right had to be designed separately. When you do something sim up, then obviously you've only got to do half and mirror it. But you can be absolutely
can be done.
But if their body from the US is molded off of an original, then that's going to have the imperfections in it anyway.
Yeah, so I would have to ask, I don't know the answer.
So if they were to send you a body, then in theory you could take a splash or a mold from that body.
Yeah.
If you're going to do something from the UK, then you're going to scan it. You're going to then model that, or surface model that, and then you're going to have to somehow produce a master. So there's probably a bit more groundwork in that sense. So if they're offering to send one over, then
yeah.
that probably is the line of least resistance.
Yeah.
But it depends. Absolutely depends.
Yeah. More discussion to have on this, because it's this is literally, like I said, just live chat. So
yeah,
I'm fascinated about how it would come about. And the one thing that, again, I've talked about on the podcast before, or publishing instead of being co-pilot, the one thing that re-engineering was really important to me is the fact that you get to see the full process, right? So this discussion really early on, really early on, the kind of the hiccups, the bits that go really well, the kind of the stuff that gets scrapped. What I don't think is existing in the YouTube space, or pretty much anywhere, is the, you know, this is your 400 page piston heads thread, right? That's what this is. If you're expecting to come back in 2 weeks and there's a car rolling out, forget it, this is not your channel. Just be temper your expectations, because I've already had a couple of, when's it ready? Not anywhere near ready. And actually, I did a conversation that was just released last week, but this will be quite a bit in the past for you guys, with Jeff from Home Built by Jeff. And he does everything himself. And even he was saying, you know, like, it's painful because people, their level of expectation is that YouTube city, you know, like, stuff gets made in 2 weeks, and it doesn't.
But it's the journey. The journey is the project. You know, yes, for the end result is the result of that, but it's the journey. But I actually, off the back of listening to that, your podcast, I went and searched through all his Instagram and YouTube, and I realised how long, I was going, how long is that project? And I think the car that he's on, the Alfa Ferrari is three and a half years in, you know, so, but it's...
And he's, and in credit to him, he's putting a lot of hours in, right?
Yeah.
It's 3 or 4 years.
Oh, you can imagine, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. But they... Projects like that take time.
Yeah,
there is that.
And especially,
sort of...
and again, he and I are quite similar in this. I think we're taking a different approach. I'm going to try and take a very engineering systems thinking approach. And he quite happily admits that he's, you know, doing everything kind of organically and testing stuff. Bought a lathe, didn't know how to use it, started from scratch. And like, again, we're in a different place, but then I think there's a different objective, right? Mm. My objective is to make something that, you know, is lighter than a Lotus Elise, is that feels delicate, like Lotus, looks like a 550 Spider, is air-cooled. There's a lot of complexity with that, and I'm fully aware that putting in a, you know, a flat four in or a flat six into something like this, that's not been done before. You know, putting a 550 Spider body onto a Model 11 chassis has not been done before. So to think that I even thought that was going to be a simple thing, like, there's going to be a lot of difficult considerations along the way. It might not even work, right? This is all very high level theory at the moment, so but you've got to try to find out.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah, but nothing to stop you from modifying the chassis, you know.
Yeah,
if you need to, you can change it.
Well, here's the thing, right, is yes and no. The one thing that's really important to me is I don't want to end up on a Q plate, so it can't be,
okay, right,
I have
okay.
to I yeah. really want to retain. And this is, so from it, if you're new to engineering at all, requirements, right? There's a level, this is what you do right at the early days of in engineering design, is you have a set of requirements. For me, one of my key requirements is, it's a road legal car that doesn't have a Q plate, so you can't modify the chassis within a tolerance. I don't want to have to then go through a huge kind of type approval process. So there are things that I want to kind of keep. And it's, I guess for me, I've seen that, like, if you're a motorsport company, MSA Blue Book, you've got your kind of, like, you know, your yearly spec, all things you can do within that year, like you're talking about with the Formula V stuff. You've got a set of things you can work within, and it's kind of finding that balance between what can I get away with, what can I absolutely not do. So for me, there's that plays, there's complex with this stuff as well, is that I've got to try and balance that off. So it's tricky, it's going to be tricky.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sounds exciting though. So when, I think you did mention it, when do you think that's going to start? You have a start.
I don't have a start. So I'm at the stage where I'm still working through talking to yourself, talking to other people that would potentially come on board to work with on something like this.
Yeah.
And by the way, Jake hasn't committed anything yet. I'm like, he's on camera going, oh my God, I haven't said a thing. But these conversations are really helpful. Even this bit where we talked about what the realities of, you know, the options I would have and that sort of stuff. So this is like pre-F&O, I guess, for a project. And at that point, when I've got to a point where I think I've got enough contacts, where there's kind of at least verbal agreement, if not kind of moving towards, well, let's discuss what that might look like. Is it as a kind of commercial activity? Then I can kind of think about when it would kick off. But I've got to do that kind of the business development. You know, what's the option? What's the feasibility of some of this stuff? Yeah, and I'm kind of not any further forward than that yet. It takes time, right?
It does.
I'm off to motorsport wiring in South Wales in 2 weeks to talk about like how, you know, I could build a wiring loom myself, but there's a difference between building a wiring loom and building one that's a motorsport spec, which again has to be really good. This is the 550 is not going to be a homebrew thing. It's got to be done to the same standard a race car would, or a, you know, a high spec road car. So
so
I'd love to say I'm going to be in, you know, in the workshop working on this stuff next week. No, it's going to, again, temper your expectations. This is how engineering happens. It is not overnight. Does that answer the question a bit?
Yeah.
No, it's like...
Yeah, but it's already begun, you know. Yeah, even the conversations mean it's begun. But, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I know we haven't even spoken about it, but absolutely we're here to support you, whether it's actually making stuff for you or pointing in the right direction,
guidance,
or materials, or whatever it might be. Absolutely, we're on board. So, yeah, sounds really cool.
It's on record now. yeah, cool. Okay, so I think it's probably a good time. What are we at? Let's have a quick look and see where we're at. An hour and four. Right. So then we're going to call it a day because Jake and I off camera a minute ago, the battery ran out. We're going to do this episode as a kind of tech talk ish. I hope you've learned some stuff out of this conversation. I've learned loads already, but an hour is long enough. So we're going to do a second episode. This episode that you're going to see next will be more about the process that they go through, O-Sport Design go through, and show you some of the kit they use and work on. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Thank you very much, Jake.
Thank you.
For doing
it's been
it.
A pleasure.
And then come back for the next episode where we'll start talking about more about the actual process that you go through. If you haven't liked, shared and followed what you're doing, do it now. At Rengineering UK on Instagram, at Rengineering pretty much everywhere else. If you want to be on Your Porsche Stories, you can email info@rengineering.com or just shoot me a DM in any one of those places. But for now, thank you very much and I will see you again very soon. Take care for now. Bye-bye. You know what's coming now, don't you? Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. What's really clear with me when I kind of watch some of these back that, you know, they've been shot a little while ago, but I know the person and I've not kind of, it's not so much me getting to know that person. It's more about the topic, but learning about them because you know somebody, but then it's, you kind of never really, when you're getting to be friends, ask questions about someone's back history. But then when there's a purpose for it and you do that, it blew my mind, all the stuff about the Formula One. I really hope you enjoyed that as well. If you want to be on Your Porsche Stories, I'm pretty much out of Your Porsche Stories content now. There's loads of other stuff that's being shot right now, but they're the big, big episodes, the big heritage stuff, the big tech talks. You can be on Your Porsche Stories, so do get in touch if you want to do that. I'm always interested. It doesn't matter what you've got in terms of, if you've got a Porsche worldwide, you know, if you're in the UK and you're not too far from the south of the country, I'll come and see you. But if you're anywhere else in the world and you're driving, doesn't matter whether it's a, you know, the most affordable 924 or kind of whatever it is, or car that's broke and it's not even working yet, I don't care. I just want to hear the stories, you know. I just want to learn from you about what makes your ownership history and experience as good as it is, and why you love the brand so much. So if you're considering doing it, if you're considering being on Your Porsche Stories, I'll take you through the whole process. You don't need to worry, you don't need to prep anything, you don't need to come with any questions or anything like that. You just need to turn up and then be ready to have a good conversation. I do the rest. If you want to do that, you can, like I said before, you can get hold of me, info@rengineering.com, ping me an email. If you want to follow on Instagram, it's at Rengineering UK on Instagram, and you can DM me there. Or Facebook, TikTok, Threads, you name it, you'll find me somehow. For now though, I really hope you're having a lovely weekend. The next episode will be just before I head off on the road trip, and I'll kind of talk to you a little bit more about what stops there are, who I'm meeting, and the plans overall. And I'll take it easy for now. See you soon. Bye-bye.